15 times. It's not that hard. We share the love, show the love, and be love.
Denny, I will start by just saying I love that you were here today, and I love the message that you have been sharing today. So thank you so much for taking time to come into the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Look forward to being up back in Florence on October 8th for another fantastic sunset.
Great, and I will be there.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in today. I'm taking a break next week, so be sure to tune in for an encore airing of one of my most popular shows, Best and Least Crowded Hikes Along the Oregon Coast with expert hiker Kevin Mickey. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door. The views, information, or opinions expressed during this program are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of KXCR and its employees, volunteers, or board members, nor do they necessarily represent those of any agencies, businesses, or organizations with which the individuals might be involved. Listeners who use information from this program to venture outdoors do so at their own risk. Outdoor activities may be hazardous and must be carefully evaluated for each listener based on that person's circumstances. KXCR and the individuals involved in this program do not assume any liability from the use of any information presented. By using this information to enjoy your own coastal adventures, you assume all potential risks and agree to hold KXCR, its affiliates, and the presenters harmless from any resulting liability.
Chavez, you're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
If people are just joining us, this is the Freedom Center's Mental Health Show, and we're speaking with Lori Ahern from Mental Disability Rights International, which does international human rights advocacy work around psychiatric and intellectual disabilities.
You know, my history and my, and my writing and my work kind of came together, and from there I then got involved with the development of the National Empowerment Center and left my journalism career after 10 years and went full-time with the National Empowerment Center.
And for people who don't know, the National Empowerment Center has been one of the leading kind of lighthouses for the psychiatric survivor movement in bringing people together and networking and really establishing some strength and political power for the psychiatric survivor human rights movement in the U.S. for ever since it began. So can you tell us a little bit about the work that the NEC does?
Well, I can tell you what it did until I left okay. 3 years ago. I think they're still on the same path, but our organization was a national organization. We had a 1-800 line. We kept a database of peer support groups all over the United States. We tried to connect people, with other people. We also ran the Alternatives Conference, which is a national conference run by patients, ex-patients, consumers, users, whatever the label is, whatever name you like to use. It was completely consumer-run conference where all the workshops were given by people themselves who had been labeled with mental illness or a diagnosis, and we would get 600, 700, 800, 900 people, and many more that would want to come as well. And so we provided resources. We also developed and did a lot of research on recovery, self-determination, what helps people get better, why some people struggle and become lifelong mental patients, and other people seem to be able to, sort of claim their lives and, regain control from, after they have been labeled with a mental illness. So we spent a lot of time doing that, and that was a big focus. And we also trained social workers and, psychologists and everything from the patient's perspective, from the ex-patient, from the consumer perspective. We worked on trying to get people in. When we started, the idea of ex-patients being at a, sitting in Washington, being at a policy meeting, having a seat at the table was pretty much unheard of, as was recovery or self-determination.
And now I think that the opposite is true. It's pretty standard. I mean, it's become really a mainstream. Recovery's become very mainstream.
There has been
very much involvement of the consumer movement in setting policy. And I think that in a lot of ways is largely a result of the work the National Empowerment Center has done over the past 15 years.
Well,
definitely.
That was certainly our goal, and it was a struggle. There were many years in the beginning that it was very much a struggle, like all kinds of other, movements, and we were it was very difficult because we were working with federal funds and we were bucking sort of the mainstream view of what a person diagnosed with a major mental illness, what their life was going to be about. But
I don't know if you mentioned one of the main people at NEC was, or still is, Judy Chamberlain, who's just been an incredible activist since the very beginnings of the psych survivor movement. We actually had her on some speaking engagements out here. Very inspiring, leader, and we hope to have her out here.
Judy Chamberlain is actually on our board at Mental Disability Rights International.
Yeah, Lori, we got to get you out here to do a speaking engagement too.
No, she's wonderful, and anyone who hasn't read her book On Our Own should call the National Empowerment Center and get it.
Absolutely.
It's fabulous.
And I think powertoyou.org.
That's right.
Is the website for the National Empowerment Center. So I think that's probably a good point to transition into talking about Mental Disability Rights International, because mostly what we've been talking about is the issues in the United States.
Right.
And what is very important for us to understand is that this is an international human rights problem. And I guess MDRI, Mental Disability Rights International, has been addressing this since 93 or something.
Right, that's correct. That's correct. excuse me. I also, like Cheryl, I think I'm finding a little cold here. Pardon me. Mental Disability Rights International came about, in 93, because really the rights of people with mental disability, which is, a broad term, but basically what we're talking about is people diagnosed with mental illness and or people with, now it's called intellectual disabilities. It was once called developmental disabilities. People with mental retardation at one point it was called, and these people have historically been bypassed by the human rights community. And Eric Rosenthal, who's the executive director, started Mental Disability Rights International because he, as a international human rights lawyer, recognized that the rights of this population were really being ignored. It's not uncommon. It's getting less common, I'm glad to say, but it was not uncommon for, say, a political prisoner to be stuck in a cage in a psychiatric institution in Russia, and an Amnesty International, or, and not to say that they don't do wonderful work, but they would, you know, there would be a big outcry that this political prisoner was in a cage in a psychiatric institution, and they would get that person out, but then the other 1,000 people in the institution, because they were labeled with mental illness, somehow the same treatment would then be considered treatment or some kind of medical intervention, whereas for someone else it was torture. Another example would be that recently, I think most of us have seen on the front pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post or the International Herald Tribune the pictures from Abu Ghraib of the prisoners with the hood and the wires hanging from them. And even though they never received any electrical torture, just the implication that they might, or the thought that they might, was considered torture, and pretty much everyone around the world agreed with that.
Right.
However, in psychiatric institutions where they are giving people electroconvulsive treatment and or, as it's known, shock treatments without anesthesia, this is considered a medical procedure. And so there was a great need for a human rights organization to focus solely on these issues, because these issues were being bypassed and somehow relegated to, well, these are medical problems. These are human rights issues. These are human rights issues. So we've been working since 1993, and we've worked in about 23 countries, mainly in Latin America, Eastern Europe, and somewhat in the Middle East. And our organization, we typically go into countries. We do very exhaustive investigations, human rights investigations. We will write up a human rights report of the results of the investigations. But one of the unique things about our organization, I think, is that we stay in the countries, and our goal is to make long-term sustainable change. And so we stay in the countries and we support the advocates there. And if there aren't too many advocates, we also then try to organize advocates.
Mm. That's really interesting. That's somewhat different than the approach that other human rights groups have been taking. So let's, this is for people who are just joining us, we're talking with Lori Ahern of Mental Disability Rights International, which does psychiatric disability, intellectual disability, human rights activism around the world. And we're just going to take a quick break. And we're back. Lori, are you there?
I am.
Okay, great. So we're talking about the music. It was Child Psychology with Black Box Recorder, which is always a very disturbing song. And then Riverman, Nick Drake. So in keeping with the down, dark mood. and the
I hate to compete with that music. It was actually very cool.
If people are just joining us, this is the Freedom Center's Mental Health Show, and we're speaking with Lori Ahern from Mental Disability Rights International, which does international human rights advocacy work around psychiatric and intellectual disabilities. And we talked a little bit about it in general, but let's talk about some specific work that you guys are doing in different countries. You mentioned that one of the campaigns that you have going on right now is with Turkey. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. I'd love to tell you about that. The idea of human rights and people with psychiatric or intellectual disabilities, I'd like to get kind of very specific, because really what you're talking about on a very deep and personal level is the right for a person to live a self-determined life, to be able to live like everyone else has the opportunity to live in the community, to have friends, to have work that's meaningful, or friends, or job, or a dog, or you know, a lover, or whatever it is that makes them happy. And unfortunately, in so many countries that we visit, these rights are non-existent. And although in the U.S. There are certainly an awful lot of problems, the situation here is at least better than in the countries that we work in. And Turkey was the most recent country that we released a report on. We spent 2 years doing investigations on the conditions of people in institutions. And these countries, the idea of community services is non-existent. In Turkey, people with, and I say mental disabilities, but invariably what happens is when we go into these institutions, it's kind of a throwaway place for anyone who doesn't fit the norm, as it were, anyone who's different. So,
well, that's
invariably,
also,
I'm sorry?
Well, that also parallels the history of the U.S., where people who had, say, encephalitis, or people who were would be called mentally retarded, people with physical illnesses were just mixed in
exactly.
with all kinds of other
exactly.
people.
Exactly, so. And that's what we find everywhere. And so in Turkey, we spent 2 years going from institution, psychiatric institution, institutions called rehabilitation centers, which are basically just warehouses for people with supposedly with developmental or intellectual disabilities, but you know, children with everything from cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, blindness, mental retardation, you know, just anything you can think of. And so we spent 2 years, we wrote a report about the conditions. And, you know, what we're about is not that we should go in and fix up institutions. I'd like to make that clear. What we're talking about is that people have a right to live in the community. They have a, you know, children have a right to have families. They have a right to go to school. These are human rights that that are being abridged everywhere throughout the world.
So, and what are some of the things that have been going on in Turkey that are a particular concern then?
Oh well, in psychiatric institutions, there are no rights. Basically, if a person gets institutionalized, they could be there for life. There is no right to a hearing. There is no right to say no to any treatment. Your family can commit you. The police can commit you. Anyone can commit you. And once you're committed, it's not uncommon to be committed for a lifetime. That's a huge issue. Electroconvulsive treatment is used just on a huge amount of patients. We found that being used, or shock treatment being used on children as young as 9 years old, and they use it without anesthesia. So we interviewed patients, and this was actually quite, I did an exhaustive sort of research on trying to find research on, you know, patients' reaction to having ECT without anesthesia. And not surprising, there wasn't much or any research on that because, you know, historically no one really cares about what the quote-unquote mental patient had to say about it, because by the fact that the mere fact that you're a mental patient, your opinion is invalidated anyway.
And in the on your website, it says that the European Convention for the Prevention of Torture actually defines electroshock without
anesthesia
as a form of torture.
That's right.
So that's, you're saying that's happening,
that's right,
regularly and routinely throughout psychiatric facilities in Turkey.
Right, right. And we also know it's happening in places like Bulgaria. It's also happening throughout India. Luckily, in most countries, it's not happening. And actually, in some European countries, Scandinavian countries especially, the use of ECT has been banned completely, not even, you know, with or without anesthesia, they don't use it. But in Turkey, we found widespread use of this. And we found children, you know, children with disabilities, both physical, mental, and a combination thereof, in facilities that were just, I mean, I it's hard to describe the physical conditions. It was so horrible. And children, once they became sick, I mean, basically the view is that these lives have no value, and once they became sick, which they invariably do when they spend 24 hours a day laying in a bed or a crib, with no movement, no...
Yeah, it's a disturbing image, but
it's
from the website. It says plastic liter bottles.
That's right.
Are permanently duct taped over the hands of young bedridden children,
right,
who, due to mind numbing boredom because they're confined in these cribs, they scratch or bite themselves.
So they
duct tape bottles over their hands.
And
this is because of the nature of psychiatric stigma and mental illness stigma. This has all been happening in the shadows, and no one's been talking
about it.
So you also mentioned that Kosovo is another place where you're doing work. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. I mean, you know, as I said, one of the unique things that we do is that we stay in the countries, and we don't just, you know, it's not a flash in the pan. We don't just write a sexy report and get lots of press and then leave. We stay to work to actually make permanent change and to support advocates in the countries. And we're doing that in Turkey now, and we've been doing it in Kosovo. We released a report in Kosovo several years ago, and, you know, there was horrible institutional and terrible conditions and no community services, and people were locked up forever, and children were in with adults. And since that time, we've been there ever since, and we have worked to support human rights activists in that province of Serbia. We have worked with international donors to say, no, don't fund Kosovo, especially after the war, and the UN, it's basically run by the UN right now. They had a lot of international donors come in, and they wanted to come in and fix up the institution. And we have been working with them and saying, no. We, you know, putting some paint on the walls and giving people new pajamas in an institution, but letting them languish there forever is not the answer. What we're talking about is people have a right to live in the community, and so we have been working with international donors to get them to funnel their money into providing small homes in the community. There is no foster care system in Kosovo, and nothing like that. But we've been able to get people out of the institution. There were, you know, in this one institution, there were over 300 people. Now we've got it down to about 80 people, and people are living in the community in small group homes, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 people, or, you know, maybe 6 or 7 children, but right in the community, and they go to school, and they play outside, and so it's a big improvement.
So, and this has just happened in a few years that these changes have been
right,
able to be
implemented. Right, in the last couple of years. We've also... MDRI has drafted a framework. We've worked with other disability groups in Kosovo in a cross-disability coalition, and we've drafted, sort of modeled after the United States, a National Council on Disability, and which people in Kosovo had never heard about, with the idea that people with disabilities could actually have a seat at the table in policymaking.
Mm-hmm. And this is similar to the kinds of things that you're doing in other countries, because I know you had mentioned Romania,
right,
Serbia, Argentina,
right,
Peru,
right,
Paraguay. I mean, there's
right,
a lot. There's
right,
so much going on. Your
right,
scope is global. Are there things that stand out that you wanted to mention and talk about a little bit?
Well, I think that, you know, well, that's a hard one, but I think what stands out to me is that people with disabilities, be it mental and or physical, are marginalized throughout the world. And That's one of the reasons we've been working so hard with, one of the things we've done is work with, in the United States, with Congress. You know, the United States gives billions of dollars throughout the world through a program called USAID, which is the United States Aid to International Development. And we have worked with Congress to say that, for instance, in Iraq or Afghanistan, if we are going to give billions of dollars to these countries should make programs and build not only buildings and schools and hospitals accessible in a physical way, but all of the programs and all of the community services should be accessible for all people. And as a result of our work with Senator Harkin and Congress, now all of the money, anything that is funded by the United States in foreign countries, has to be accessible to people with disabilities.
Wow, that's fantastic. So people want to find out more about the work that Lori is talking about. The group is Mental Disability Rights International, and the website is www.mdri.org. Lori, one of the things that really interests me especially is the way in which disability rights is becoming a global standard and a global movement and really becoming part of the established human rights discussion and priorities. And one of the ways that that's happening is through the work that MDRI and you've been doing, and also the National Empowerment Center, and I know Judy Chamberlain have been doing at the United Nations.
Right.
Do you want to talk about that? Because I think that's something that is extremely exciting, and it's very much historic work, and people don't really know anything about it.
Sure. At the present time at the United Nations, there is a process going on where there is a drafting of a convention, not unlike the Convention for Women, the Convention for Children, the Convention Against Torture. There is a very historic drafting of a convention going on for the rights and protection of people with disabilities worldwide. And this really elevates, at a human rights level, the protections for people with disabilities. And conventions typically at the UN I think the Convention on Women and Children took somewhere in the vicinity of 8 to 10 years. But the convention being written for people with disabilities is on the fast track, and it's slated to be finished by the end of this year.
So what are some of the features of this convention? What does it say, and what are some of the goals that it sets out? How might it change things around the world?
Well, I think it will change things in a huge way, because it really lays out, you would think that it would already be laid out that people with disabilities have the same rights as everyone else, but unfortunately that's not the case. I guess that's why they decided that they needed a special convention for children, for women. But it really reinforces the rights of people with disabilities. And so we have countries, you know, at the UN, there is it's called an ad hoc committee, which is a committee of many of the different countries that are part of the UN, and then certain non-governmental agencies and organizations such as MDRI. And we just go over every single article about the protections and what the rights are. So, for instance, this would say that, you know, if you are committed to a psychiatric hospital, you have a right to a hearing. Now, that may seem very elementary in the United States, perhaps, but in all of the countries that I have been to, people don't have that right, and they get put into a psychiatric institution, and they are literally there for their lifetime. Or children have children with mental disabilities or disabilities have a right to live with a family, have a right to live in the community. In the places I go, children with disabilities are put in institutions as children, and then they're there till they're 18 years old, and then they're transferred to a psychiatric institution, and they are condemned to live their lives in institutions. So this convention will have huge implications, and organizations such as mine will be able to take countries to courts, to the European court, to the Inter-American Court on Human Rights in Latin America. They will have to abide by these conventions, by this convention.
And I know from the work that we do here in Northampton, Hampshire County, and Western Massachusetts, that, I mean, this is really some leverage. I mean, it doesn't solve the problem, but what it does is it creates more leverage that give human rights advocates and activists and people who've been subjected to abuses in their families and their friends some kind of tools that they can make change. I mean, in the U.S., we should remember that, you know, prior to like 1973 or so, people didn't necessarily have a right to a commitment hearing. It depended on the state, and most states didn't have.
And today,
well, you have the legal right to a commitment hearing, but, you know, there's still problems because it's often there are kangaroo courts, and, you know, the judge sort of does whatever the psychiatrist wants. The legal representation is really poor. We also have, it wasn't until the early, I don't remember what year the Olmstead decision was, that basically said, you know, you can't keep people in an institution if they could get care in the community.
Right.
It's just not right. And now there still is many, many instances of situations where people are still held against their will and in institutions when there would be less restrictive alternatives in the community. But the reality is that things have changed,